You ever hear something that the government did and it made you think, well, God, you know, if they're doing that, what on earth could they possibly be doing that we don't know about? You know, I mean, we had the whole NSA scandal a couple of years ago where we found out that the government was listening in to all of our phone conversations, or at least had access to it. And that kind of freaked a lot of people out. And then you just have all of these other declassified documents from the Cold War era that really lend credence to maybe the government really was behind JFK. Maybe we really did, I don't know, whatever all the other crazy government conspiracies are out there. A lot of the things that we're going to be talking about today are probably going to really shake your faith in what the government is actually doing. And maybe that's a good thing. Or maybe not. We'll discuss it. It's Our Weird World.
Our Weird World.
Welcome to Our Weird World. I'm your host, John Henson. And this week we are looking at some very real government projects that, you know, just aren't going to make you feel real great about, you know, how you feel about the government. You know, there, and obviously there are two sides to this coin. You know, you may be one of those people who think that the government was perfectly right in doing these projects and that it was for the greater good and that their job is to protect us so that we can have the freedoms that we shout and scream about and say that we're number one and all that kind of stuff. And this is just what comes with it. And on the other hand, you could be one of those people who are like, that's too far. And these people should be put in jail forever over it. So we'll see how you feel at the end. We're going to be talking about a few different projects here. Project MK Ultra, Operation Wetback, Operation Dropkick, Project Chariot, and Operation Acoustic Kitty. So let's jump in right now. Story time. So we're starting shortly after World War II. When the United States government effectively just declared to the rest of the planet that you're not going to mess with us, right? We will go to unprecedented lengths to end wars, such as we're just going to start dropping nuclear bombs everywhere. And the country, the United States, spent the next couple of decades because of this in this weird experimental phase, you know, mostly due to the Cold War and just this paranoia that Russia was doing a lot of their own crazy stuff, which to a degree they were. And they were just going to just try everything just to see how maniacal, how powerful they could be and just what kind of insane things they could do just if they wanted to or if they needed to. And on April 13th, 1953, CIA Director Alan Dulles placed a man named Sidney Gottlieb in charge of another new scientific project, one of many that was going on in the CIA at the time. And this one was called Project MK Ultra. And during this experiment, Gottlieb's goal was to create mind-controlling drugs that could be used against Soviet leaders because two things. One, the United States was convinced that life was basically just one giant science fiction movie at this point. And two, the Soviets, Chinese, and North Koreans had used mind control tactics on American prisoners during the Korean War. Now, did they use mind controlling truth serums and all that kind of stuff? Not really. I mean, they were just torturing them to death. But the United States was like, hey, guys, maybe instead of torture or other crazy interrogation tactics, we could just come up with a drug that allows us to control people's minds. And so that's where Project MK Ultra was born. MKUltra was comprised of over 150 government-funded sub-projects because, really just because the government was paranoid about the rise of communism, and they were actually starting to fear that they had already lost their place as the strongest nuclear superpower in the world. And, you know, at times during the Cold War, you know, it just went back and forth so much that, you know, there were probably periods there where the United States really did feel like they were losing. CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton even believed that a spy had infiltrated the CIA, which happened for sure. We will have a future episode down the road where we talk about KGB spies that infiltrated the FBI and CIA. But, you know, Angleton believed that a spy had infiltrated the CIA and had actually gotten into the highest levels of the organization. And he wanted to be able to figure out who that was. And he thought the best way to do this was to develop mind control drugs or substances to have that person reveal themselves. In all, Project MKUltra funded a variety of studies to research several different mind-altering substances that either changed or inhibited a person's mind and or body. And these sort of ways they did that would include illogical thinking, impulsiveness, faster aging, which is crazy, amnesia, paralysis, blisters, poor vision, temporary or permanent brain damage, and just a bunch of other things. But because the United States was lacking in foreign prisoners of war to experiment on during this time, they just decided that it was perfectly justified to experiment on American citizens, especially if they had no idea that they were part of the experiment. Ethics, not huge in the Cold War. All right. The study quickly began focusing on a new drug called LSD-25, which had originally been discovered by Albert Hofmann in Switzerland in 1943. MKUltra scientists began giving LSD-25 to mental patients, prisoners, and sex workers. And these were all people the CIA labeled as, quote, those who could not fight back. Yeah. Even like this, it's already going to start off heavy. The CIA also gave the drug to other CIA employees, military members, doctors, and the general public, all without their informed consent, with the hope of wiping out a person's memory and then reprogramming them as a robot agent. All right. So 1953, the government is out there just unknowingly infecting people with a new drug that they're not even sure what it actually does yet, but they're hoping that it can just turn people basically into patriot zombies, for lack of a better term, and, you know, so that we can weed out the communists and then also just get everybody all on one side and become like the Empire in Star Wars or something, just a bunch of stormtroopers running around. In one instance, Army biochemist Frank Olson was unknowingly given LSD after a CIA operative spiked his drink with the drug. When Olson began reacting to the drug, he ran out of the room because he didn't know that his drug had been spiked, and he's freaking out. It took the CIA several hours to track him down, and they found him hiding in a ditch, shaking in fear. Like, he's just, you know, involuntarily shaking because he is so scared as to what is happening to his body, because he has no idea he's been drugged. When Olson returned home after the CIA kind of got him cleaned up, like, his wife could clearly tell that something was wrong. And she and Olson's coworkers checked him into a mental health facility for evaluation. And then a week later, he chucked himself out of a 13th story window and killed himself. But wait, guys, it gets better. During Operation Midnight Climax, great name, by the way, and you'll see why here in a second, this was a sub-project within Project MKUltra, the CIA actually set up brothels inside government safe houses in San Francisco and then lured men inside under the guise of adult fun time, knowing that they would be too embarrassed to talk about anything that happened there, right? Because a lot of these guys are probably married men. They're going to these brothels to get their, you know, to get the wah-wah-wah, whatever. I don't know what that was. But, you know, the government knew that they would do that and then be too ashamed, or the stakes would be too high for them to go talk about it in public, so they could just do whatever they wanted. The CIA then gave the LSD to the prostitutes the government had hired, and then they filmed everything that happened inside the brothels. All right. So in this entire operation, okay, the government is not only hiring prostitutes, not only giving them LSD to then give to their clients, but they're filming all of it. So there's a decent chance that deep within the CIA archives, there's just a bunch of footage of random people doing it with prostitutes while high on LSD. Oh my God. And there's people out there who think that they want to go back to living in those times. Go back to the good old days. Back when, you know, back when there wasn't so much sex and, you know, cursing and violence on the TV and the radio. You know, just back when the government was funding prostitution and LSD and filming all of it. Cool. In other experiments, CIA employees and military members who were given LSD without their knowledge were then placed in isolated rooms and underwent intense interrogation. All right. I've never done LSD. Would kind of like to. Maybe not so much after reading about all this. But you're giving, you know, I've never done LSD. But based on what I've heard other people say about their experience in LSD, them in the middle of a trip and then them also being severely interrogated by the government does not sound like a good time. The people who were being interrogated were told that their trips would be prolonged if they refused to reveal their secret identities, which didn't actually exist. But several people actually ended up dying from these interrogation exercises. But the government was just out there drugging people with LSD, then throwing them in this interrogation room. And it's just like, reveal your true identity. What is your KGB name?
I don't know, man. I don't know. Just make it stop. I see pink porcupines everywhere, man. Your hair is like purple sea anemones, man.
I don't know why Tommy Jong is being interrogated. LSD wouldn't do anything to Tommy. Anyway, I'm sorry. That's off on another tangent again. Ordinary, at least, you know, at the time, citizens, like mobster Whitey Bulger and Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, which will be absolutely the subject of a future episode, were unknowingly given LSD as part of Project MKUltra experiments. Studies were even conducted in Canada. Same thing was happening. Just random Canadian citizens were just given LSD just to see what would happen. Unfortunately, the CIA destroyed most of this project's records in 1973 following the government panic after the Watergate scandal. Thanks, Nixon. So the full scale of Project MKUltra will never truly be known. This is just what we know. This is just what was declassified and not destroyed after Watergate. So more than likely, it's way worse than what it is. But yeah, the government just giving out LSD and really freaking people out. Well, it gets better, all right? Because the next year, in 1954, the United States and Mexico began the Bracero program. The Bracero program, which allowed Mexicans to work in the United States with the understanding that the U.S. would strengthen its border security and return illegal immigrants to Mexico. Huh. Crazy how we're still dealing with that. Almost like, what, 80 years later? 70 years later? 70. Almost 70 years later. We're still just kind of like having this, I don't know, I want to call it a problem, but, you know, we're still, Mexican immigration is just still an issue, and we haven't figured it out yet. Not that, I don't even know that it is an issue, just some people think it is. You know, I don't want Mexicans coming in stealing our jobs, whatever, because, God, guys, we love picking fruits and vegetables and making Mexican food in restaurants. Such a drag. Can't believe there aren't enough white people who want to do those jobs. Anyway, but rather than, where we were at here, kind of still in the Korean War, kind of transitioning to the Vietnam War in a few years, but rather than sending its troops to help fight in the Korean War, Mexico promised to just send cheap labor, which number one export, probably. And to help Americans, you know, continue building the economy while most of their soldiers were off fighting in the war. And so that's what this Bracero program was. Mexico hoped that the return of illegal immigrants, which at this point was averaging 100,000 per year since the 1920s, would allow the country to grow its economy and fix its own labor shortage that it had created from all of the illegal immigration. So I'm going to try to explain this again because I feel like I didn't explain it very well. The Bracero program basically was that the United States and Mexico got together, and the United States was like, hola, senor, because that's your language. Because, of course, we're going to be condescending about it. Here's what we're going to do, all right? We're gonna fix this border problem so that you guys can stop coming over here illegally, all right? And we're going to just deport all the illegals back over to Mexico. And in return, you can just send people here legally to do all the jobs that our soldiers should be doing if they hadn't just drafted them to go to war. And Mexico was totally cool with this for some reason, because I guess there were more. I guess they thought more people had come into America legally than actually done so the right way. And so they thought America returning all of their illegal immigrants would in turn help their economy, which makes no sense. It's not a logical solution to a problem at all. But and of course, you shouldn't be surprised to know that this did not work at all. The United States, in Mexico's opinion, didn't really do much to increase its border security, which have we ever? We always talk about doing stuff. Oh, we're going to build a wall. Oh, we're going to crack down. We're going to put Border Patrol agents out there, and you never do anything like that. Even more, the Bracero program had actually allowed 2 million Mexicans to legally travel to the United States, which then caused more economic problems in Mexico and resulted in food shortages because everyone who would have normally been tending the crops there left for the States to do the same job over here. And eventually, tensions rose to a point that the United States was actually forced to do something about it. And so on May 17th, 1954, the United States formally began Operation Wetback, which was a tactical cooperation with the Mexican government to get all of the illegal Mexicans back across the border. I'm not sure if the Mexican government signed off on that name, but that's just what they ended up calling it. Now, granted, because I know there, I can feel some snowflake energy coming at me, that maybe wetback was not a racial slur back in the 1950s. Point heard. I just think it's funny now that the United States used racial terms for their operations. Led by General Joseph Swing, 750 Border Patrol agents using 350 vehicles and 7 airplanes began swooping in and deporting anyone who looked remotely Mexican. All right. Didn't even matter if they were here illegally or not. It's just like, you know, hey, Carlos. What? My name's Dave. I'm not even Mexican. Yeah. Okay, hermano. S.A. Get in the van. You're going back across the border. What are you talking about, dude? I work outside. I have a tan. My family has like Italian heritage. I'm naturally a little bit darker skinned. Okay, get your sombrero, pack it up, let's go. Anyway, although the focus of the operation was along the Texas border, there were also other Operation Wetback activities going on in Chicago, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. When the operation ended a year later, over 1 million Mexicans had been moved back to Mexico, though, you know, over half of them actually just fled back to Mexico on their own out of fear of being deported. So, I don't know, according to whatever political side you're on, it seemed like pretty worked out pretty well. While scared and racist white people rejoiced at the shrinking number of Mexicans in the country, the actual operation was just a disaster, just an unorganized mess, mainly because the United States didn't actually make much of an effort to return the Mexicans to the part of Mexico they had originally come from. It's just like, hey, hey, Taco, Paco, whatever your name is, get in the van. You're going back to Mexico, all right? Si, senor. Can you take me back to my home of Monterrey? No. No. You might. I don't know where you're going. Probably like Guadalajara, Cancun. Cancun's probably nice. I went there for my honeymoon. It's pretty sweet. You're going to Cancun, right? No, sir. My home is in Monterrey. Don't care. You're going to Cancun. Be grateful. Everyone, and that's really what happened. Like, everyone who was deported was just simply dropped off at a random location in some part of Mexico, which then left people scrambling to not only figure out where they were, but then also to how to get home. And the Mexican government, they didn't care either. They're just like, "Yeah, cool, glad to have you back. Please go find a job here. Thanks." So there you go. This next one, a little bit of a short one. In 1956, the U.S. Army Chemical Corps began Operation Dropkick, another super sweet name. The plan was to test the feasibility of turning mosquitoes, which are already annoying disease machines in regular everyday life, but they wanted to turn them into swarming death bugs. And the idea was that basically the United States could build bug farms with mosquitoes that already carried infectious diseases, and then they could take those mosquitoes, cram them into a bomb, and drop them on the enemy because they just, I guess they forgot Africa was a place they could just harvest disease-ridden mosquitoes for free. But whatever. I think I just called them mosquitoes. Mosquitoes. I don't know. Mosquitoes sounds fun. Anyway, but here's the thing. The United States wasn't about to just implement that program without testing it first. There's a scientific method involved, you guys. So what they did to test, because I can't imagine any foreign government would have been okay with this, they just decided that it was totally fine to drop a total of 600,000 uninfected mosquitoes on the town of Avon Park, Florida, just to see what would happen. And after the infestation, the Corps observed how many mosquitoes were able to break into people's houses and bite them. Not just outside. Mosquitoes were getting inside, breaking into people's houses, and just wreaking havoc on people. Within a day, the Corps reported that mosquitoes had bitten, quote, many people, which is probably almost everyone. And for whatever reason, they just decided to stop there. So, you know, congratulations, Florida. We're just going to drop a mosquito bomb on you. Let a bunch of people get a bunch of very irritating, itchy bumps. And then, you know, we'll go on to something else. And so that's what they did. In 1958, physicist Edward Teller thought that Alaska needed another deep water harbor. If you don't know anything about Alaska, most of the settlements there are on the coast. They have plenty of harbors, but apparently, you know, physicists who know a lot about the economy and, you know, the need for harbors and ports of entry, I guess, whatever. And so since this was the 1950s and the United States was super into atomic weapons, Teller figured that the easiest and best way to create a deep water harbor was to drop 6 hydrogen bombs near Cape Thompson, which is in a very remote, even by Alaska's standards, a very remote place on the northwestern tip of the state. So, I mean, you're going way, way up. And because the Atomic Energy Commission had more nukes than they knew what to do with at this point, Project Chariot was born. Now, of course, the people of Alaska were not thrilled with this idea. For starters, the area near Cape Thompson was frozen for most of the year, which makes a harbor there pretty pointless already. There was also a colony of Inuit people. I think that's the right thing. I don't know. We're apparently not allowed to say Eskimo anymore. I think Inuit is okay still. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I'm sorry. But there was a colony of Inuit people 30 miles away who would be greatly affected by this, if not entirely wiped out by the nuclear fallout that would be created from dropping 6 hydrogen bombs on Cape Thompson. Well, Teller was adamant that the blast from these nuclear bombs would already be creating a 1,000-foot crater that was 110 feet deep. He was adamant that this would be totally harmless because the government had already figured out a way to make the atomic bombs less radioactive and reduce the amount of distance that the radioactive particles could travel following a detonation. To back up Teller's statement, a scientist from the Atomic Energy Commission named John Wolf conducted a preliminary study of the area to prove that everything would be totally fine. However, he was very shocked to discover that it was already covered in radioactive material. And apparently, the lichen, you know, the little moss thingies on rocks or whatever, like green and white little things, it's called lichen. But the lichen in the area had captured fallout from tests conducted in the Pacific Ocean over 7,000 miles away. Caribou, the primary source of food for the Inuits, ate the lichen and thus transmitted the radioactive fallout from the lichen to the caribou to the Inuits. So they were already dealing with radiation, albeit very small amounts, but it came from the Pacific Ocean and the atolls and the islands over 7,000 miles away. So that's kind of a problem. And the results of this report gave protesters even more evidence that the Inuits and the surrounding landscape would be greatly affected by dropping an atomic bomb on them, as, you know, that's right. Regardless of how improved and less radioactive it was, which I don't think anybody actually believed that. Project Chariot, fortunately, was quickly abandoned, but the United States was not about to give up on nuking its own land. Another effort to nuke the country for engineering efficiency was proposed 5 years later and involved dropping 22 nuclear bombs through the Bristol Mountains in California for the construction of Interstate 40. Well, there was a bunch of technical issues around dropping nukes on California, so that project was abandoned as well, and they figured out how to construct the road. But crazy. This last one's probably my favorite. So again, now we're moving into the 60s. At this point, the government is just willing to listen to any idea that would help them gain an advantage over the Russians. And so in 1961, someone in the CIA thought it would be a brilliant idea to outfit a cat with spy equipment and then have it do, you know, whatever things cats do around a group of Russians. And basically, while the cat was doing, you know, its little cat things, it would also be transmitting everything it was recording back to the CIA. Now, you could get away with doing that today because we have abilities to just have tiny little microphones, maybe even tiny little cameras that you could put inside a cat's fur, totally invisible. All right. Not in 1960. All right. Everything is still big and bulky, but doesn't matter because the CIA had practically free rein to do whatever they wanted to do in the 1960s, they moved forward with what came to be known as Operation Acoustic Kitty. They picked a gray and white female cat from wherever the CIA gets their cats from and began working with audio engineers and veterinarians to figure out how to put spy equipment on her. 5 years and $20 million later, they thought they had perfected it, all right? So over the course of an hour, a team of veterinarians implanted a small microphone in the cat's ear. They then placed a radio transmitter at the base of her skull and then ran thin wire in and around her spine. So when this new cyborg kitty was complete, the CIA took it to the Soviet compound on Wisconsin Avenue in Washington, D.C. so it could spy on a couple of Russian men sitting in the adjacent park. Now, I'm going to play a little game here. All right, I'm going to give you four options as to what happened next, because it's pretty great. Option number one, the cat immediately went up to the men, purring so loudly that the CIA couldn't hear any of the conversation that was being recorded. Number two, the cat did not have any interest in the CIA or in the Russians at all, and instead just started chasing after birds. Or C, the cat just kind of plopped itself on a sunny spot on the sidewalk and refused to move and actually get close enough to the Russians to hear the conversation. Or option number four, none of the above. Please put in your answers now after this brief, fun little music intro. Interlude. Yes, that. Okay, what did you guess? Did you guess that the cat purred so loud that the CIA couldn't hear anything? Maybe the cat chased after a bird? or plopped itself down on a nice sunny spot? No. The correct answer is D, none of the above, because, look, while those first three options are certainly plausible, in fact, what's even worse is that as soon as the CIA released the cat, it ran across the street where it was immediately hit by a car and died. Dead kitties make me sad, all right? It's one of my least favorite things to think about, but God, that is just so comically ridiculous that the CIA spends 5 years and $20 million on outfitting a cat with recording technology just for it to go get hit by a car within seconds of them releasing it. Oh, yeah, they abandoned that project a year later. All right. So, yeah, let's talk about it. All right. How do you feel? How do you feel about the government right now? All right. Crazy. Super villainy. Yeah. All right. These things actually happened. Who knows what other things the CIA was doing during the 50s and 60s, even up till today, that we don't know about, that, you know, could greatly influence how we see the government. All right. Now, look, here's the thing. Like, I get both sides of it. All right. On one hand, totally agree that a lot of this stuff was really ridiculous, probably unnecessary. I definitely don't think that the United States is not the greatest country in the world. I don't know that you can actively define what the greatest country in the world is. I can tell you that if you look at any study, whether it's, you know, economy, overall, like how people live, quality of life, you know, America is not even close to being the number one country in the world, right? At best, we're, you know, top 20 for sure. But when you look at overall happiness, overall freedom, which I think is really ironic. Like, America is like, yeah, we're the land of the free. These are my freedoms. America is not a super free country. All right, there are so many laws on the books. We have the highest percentage of incarcerated people than any other country on the planet. We make laws that restrict other people's freedoms so that one other group of people, you know, their lives don't change at all, actually. You know, the big thing is, like, whether it's like gay marriage or transgender rights, all that kind of stuff, like, none of that stuff infringes on other people's freedoms, but there are certainly a lot of people who want to restrict those people from having the same freedoms as, you know, quote unquote, regular people do. I know that's not the right thing to say, the right word to use, but you get the point. You know, and what's funny is, like, the people who scream the loudest that the United States is the best country in the world are usually the people who were born and raised and have lived their entire lives, maybe the exception of going off to college, within 30 miles, like in the same 30-mile radius, their entire life. And that's, you can't truly understand the United States, and you can't understand how other countries operate and how other people live, how other cultures view the world, if that's how your life has played out. All right. You're certainly entitled to your opinion, but understand that your opinion is very closed off, very limited, and not as well-rounded as someone who has traveled, who has spent time living in other cities and other states and other countries. All right. Look, I mean, you know, it's ironic that I'm saying this. You know, I was born and raised in North Carolina. I live 3.5 hours from where I was born. I've traveled basically the entire eastern half of the United States. I've been to Canada. That's the extent of my international travels. So it's sort of ironic that I'm the one saying this, because I'm not that far removed from someone who's just lived in the same spot their entire life. But I've taken the time to just observe and look at how other people live their lives. And it's just so obvious to me that America's great, right? I'm not saying that it sucks to live here. So don't come at me, bro, with your, well, if you don't like it, just leave. All right. No, mainly because a lot of countries make it difficult to move there, just like America makes it difficult for people to move here. But that's another discussion entirely. And I know I've like derailed the entire podcast with my little soapbox rant here, but man, just before you say that America is the best country in the world, do a little bit of research, all right? Not saying that we're a terrible company, but man, places like Norway, you know, the Scandinavian countries, even Hong Kong, despite their current political situation, consistently ranks higher than the United States in terms of overall happiness and freedoms, even though they are essentially China's gross skin tag. And China wants to, you know, not cut off the skin tag, but they want to just take it over and really fully embrace it. So that's all I'm saying. Just, you know, do some research, because I think you're going to learn a lot about just how not great America is. It's very much been a giant branding campaign to make America seem better than it is. And it's okay. It's okay to admit that it's not great, because I think that that allows us to make a lot of much needed improvements. But that was that. Otherwise, let's see what we learned today.
What did we learn?
Number one, the government gave LSD to people when they didn't know it. America, the original date rapists. Number two, that's a great campaign. Number two, the United States legitimately had a government operation called Operation Wetback. The immature person in me wants to also spout off a bunch of other fake operation names with racial slurs, but I don't want to get in trouble, but I'm sure you can come up with fun ones on your own. And number three, the U.S. government tried to outfit a cat with recording technology, and after $20 million, the cat just ran out and killed itself, which I think we all would if that's what happened to us. Next week on Our Weird World, we are going on location, kind of. Well, I mean, like, I'm still going to be broadcasting from my house, but the show is going to be all about the city of Philadelphia. Not my favorite place that I've ever been to, but it's got a lot of history, and we're going to look at some of Philadelphia's strangest characters and people and events from history. We're going to look at the life of Steuben's Firth, William Kimmler. We're going to talk about the Blob, and we're also going to talk about Ed Savitz, and that's going to be a fun story. So yeah, it's not going to be the greatest travel brochure in support of Philadelphia tourism, but then again, I don't think anything about this show has ever painted anything in a positive light, and we're going to continue that tradition next week. So thank you all for continuing to listen. Keep telling all your friends about the show, and tell them to like and subscribe and leave reviews, and you should leave a review and all of that kind of good stuff. So yeah, keep it weird.